during my one of my early jobs, I was one of two Asian women who had just started at the company, and the other Asian woman didn't look anything like me. That she was Vietnamese and French. She was probably a foot shorter than me. We wore different glasses. We had different styles of dress. We looked completely different, you know, different hair lengths, like different in every sense of the word. Like if you put us side by side, there is no way that somebody would mistake us for sisters or anything like that. But anyway, I was waiting at the elevator bank going home on my, you know, one of my first weeks at work, and the CTO of the company comes up to me and he says, "Oh, how are you finding it here, Vanessa?" I was like, "I'm not Vanessa. I'm not Vanessa." It was so awkward. I didn't really know what to say. I think I just was like, "Oh, I think you should ask Vanessa." I don't even remember what I said at the time.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Denise Yu. Denise is a senior engineer at GitHub and a prolific speaker. She's also an awesome cartoonist who has co-written and illustrated a book called A Children's A to Z of Continuous Delivery. Excellent. In this episode, we dive deep into the role that gender plays in inclusion. We talk about pronouns and gendered language and the invisible cost that women and minorities pay for speaking out. We also cover solutions that can help us narrow that gap between men and women on our engineering teams. Right now, we're in a challenging period for engineering leaders. That's why I'm dedicating time to answer questions about engineering leadership. If you have questions about building and managing remote teams or otherwise, email me at wes@woventeams.com and I'll try to help you out. Again, that's wes@woventeams.com so I can help you work through problems. And now, here's my conversation with Denise Yu. I'm excited for our conversation on collaboration, trust building, trust breaking, inclusion. I think that's going to be our theme and how language is important. So you recently wrote an article on remote collaboration, which is a thing we're all currently forced to do a little bit right now. We're kind of, it's March 11th when we're recording this, coronavirus. What are some things you learned about, you'd recommend for remote collaboration?
I think one of the biggest lessons that I learned while I was working on both co-located teams and distributed teams during my time at Pivotal is that if you have even one person that's remote, and remote can mean they're in a different city, or it can mean they're just home for the day because they have to tend to a sick child or a relative or whatever it is, one thing that makes a huge difference in terms of inclusion is to adhere to what I call parity of remoteness. I didn't make up the term. I actually don't know who did. But it's the idea that if one person is remote, then everyone goes remote. Because it's sort of like forward-looking a little bit too, because it acknowledges that having a team operate in a remote way is a different skill set than in-person collaboration. And when you have an opportunity to build that, it's worth taking that opportunity to, you know, like invest in developing that skill set. So what that means pragmatically is everyone gets a headset and jumps on a video call. You don't do the thing where you have six people in a room and you dial in one person on the monitor. I've been that person many, many times. I've been the person also in the room. And just in terms of latency, you know, like you're always going to have a few milliseconds or maybe a few seconds if, you know, if your internet's not great, of lag, that's going to prevent that person from participating 100%. But the person on the screen can't see body language. They can't read, you know, audio visual cues of when it's time for them to jump in. So the impact of that I see over and over again is that the person on the wall tends to just end up observing and not fully participating. And I really don't like that, because the more that happens, the more their voice gets crowded out. And also, like, it's bad for the whole team because the team is losing opportunities to figure out how to include everybody and get the most diverse perspective on a problem that, you know, you're supposed to be solving as a team.
If anyone's remote, then everyone's remote. What else should we be thinking about as we're moving more remote?
I think another big thing is to invest in written communication as a skill that is not organic. It's not something that people are naturally better at than other people. It's actually just another skill like programming or like, you know, like facilitation that needs to be developed. So written communication takes a lot of forms, I think, when you work as an engineer, it can mean the feedback that you write to someone on their pull request, or it can mean sort of like kind of real-time written communication like Slack, or the more asynchronous comms like email or Google Docs. But in all cases, I think one thing that's worth it for teams to do is to sit down and come up with a sort of like a working agreement around the team's written communication. So you might want to set agreements around, for example, like how much time should we, you know, like give each other to respond to urgent communications, non-urgent communications on Slack, on email, on Google Docs before we chase them up? What's the best way to follow up? Like, do you prefer to follow up on Zoom? Do you prefer to follow up asynchronously? And like have conversations around how to manage the turnaround of urgent tasks so that you're not kind of anxiously pinging each other on Slack all the time and sort of burning goodwill on that kind of communication that doesn't really matter. Those are things that can be solved with a working agreement. I've also heard of people like the concept of a manager README or a report README, sort of like a set of guidelines around how you prefer to be communicated with and how you prefer to interact with teams. So I think the team as a whole could look into something like that, sort of explore that pattern.
So we have written, we get better at writing, and then we also have written agreements. A written agreement should cover communication expectations, so escalation, paths, preferences, and you've seen manager READMEs as a good tool for that. I love that. What about kind of practical tools? I know tools are less important than the policies and processes, but what tools have you found to be useful?
So in my time at Pivotal, the two tools that I think we couldn't work remotely without are Zoom for video chat. Google Hangouts also works for a lot of people, but we found that Zoom works better when you have people signing up with different internet speeds. And the other one is a tool called Miro. It used to be called Real-Time Board, but it's essentially an in-browser whiteboarding tool. I love the tool. I don't know if it'll work for everyone, but the way that the teams that I worked on did product development, we did a lot of ceremonies that involved getting ideas out of people's heads and then sort of converging those ideas and picking, you know, identifying a problem together, identifying a solution together, identifying risks and mitigations. And those are things that we would have done with probably 50 post-its and Sharpies in a room together. Miro was the most intuitive tool that we came across that felt like it could be a real online replacement of that process.
Plus one, Miro. I've been using it since a real-time board. It is a game changer for remote collaboration for those processes that you really need sticky notes. I love that. A couple other things I loved in your article, you talked about a gaming headset that has a physical mute, which I have come around to. Why do you recommend that physical mute?
So I really like having a hardware mute in addition to software mute. First of all, because if you are somewhat disorganized on a desktop like I am, you might have like 12 different desktop apps open at any given point. And sometimes if I leave my headset on and I'll start talking or start, you know, getting sound input from like, I don't know which app it is, and I have to tap through and figure it out. So that's the first reason. But the second reason is that when you're on a video call, if you have a hardware mute that involves you moving your hand to your face, and I know right now everyone's saying, don't touch your face, so don't touch your face, touch the hardware, touch, you know, the microphone. But essentially, the microphone is a very obvious, you know, bar that you can lift from the side of your face. So when it's up, you're muted. When it's down, you want to talk. That to me is a really strong visual indicator that you're trying to jump into a conversation. And I know with like remote calls, with group conversations already, especially if you're more of a, you know, less outspoken person, or you're more junior, or you're, you know, just someone who's been used to not being told that your opinions matter, let's say, it might be already, you know, socially difficult to jump in. So I think that having some way to visually signal that you're ready, that's, you know, intuitive and easy to pick up, I think that that's a worthwhile investment. And I know that I spoke to some friends yesterday about this, and I learned that on some chat apps, everyone is muted by default. So if you unmute yourself, that also is kind of an indicator that you want to jump in. Or people will use like physical cues, like they'll hold a finger up next to their face. Or like one team I was on even experimented with Occupy Wall Street hand signals, which are, you basically use your entire arm to signal like, I agree, or I disagree, or I want to jump in, or something like that. So you just have to experiment with like different things will work for different teams. And, you know, like the personalities of the people on the team matter. But to me, like the hardware mic, like flip the mic down to jump in, has been just like universally a really strong signal.
Man, I've been using this, and for me, the reason is like the mute, because I hate feeling like a, you know, bozo because I unmuted or I didn't mute fast enough. But I didn't realize I was signaling when I dropped my mic down. Of course, that makes it easier for me to get in the conversation. And that's not a problem I have usually. I feel like I get If anything, people let me talk a little bit too much, but I think there's other folks that that would help. That's a really awesome recommendation. So I want to talk a little bit about intersectionality, just so you get kind of your perspective. So you're an East Asian woman. I'm interested in how that experience might be different when it comes to how that might have framed your experience when it comes to inclusion and diversity and work.
So I am East Asian by, I guess, ethnicity and by birth, but I was born in America. I always get confused about this. I don't know if I'm first generation or my mom is first generation.
I get confused about that too.
Yeah, I think the term is kind of vague, but I will call myself first generation born in the States. But the privileges I have there are, you know, like having been born in America, having an American passport, of course, having English as my first language, having gone, like, done all of my schooling in English speaking countries, and having, you know, had the incredible privilege of attending university and, you know, achieving higher education. So I just want to acknowledge off the bat, there's already a tremendous amount of privilege that I navigate the world with, that I know a lot of other East Asian, you know, like presenting women and men, like, and non-binary people don't share. But I think in terms of navigating the tech industry, I've actually been incredibly lucky. And I don't know what it is about my experience versus the experience of other people, because I speak to other women and non-binary people who have just had horrible experiences and, like, been discriminated against and misgendered and all this stuff. But so far, like, in the 5 years that I've been in this industry, I've been pretty lucky that I haven't experienced overt racism. I've experienced a little bit of sexism. I would say most of, like, the bias I've directly encountered has probably been more to do with my gender than my race. But the only time that I could really think of something, I guess, like, racially inclined happening was when, during one of my early jobs, I was one of two Asian women who had just started at the company, and the other Asian woman didn't look anything like me. In fact, she was Vietnamese and French. She was probably a foot shorter than me. We wore different glasses. We had different styles of dress. We looked completely different, you know, different hair lengths, like, different in every sense of the word. Like, if you put us side by side, there is no way that somebody would mistake us for sisters or anything like that. But anyway, I was waiting at the elevator bank going home on my, you know, one of my first weeks at work, and the CTO of the company comes up to me and he says, "Oh, how are you finding it here, Vanessa?"
I was like, "Oh no,
I'm not Vanessa. I'm not Vanessa." It was so awkward. I didn't really know what to say. I think I just was like, "Oh, I think you should ask Vanessa." I don't even remember what I said at the time.
I hope he died a little bit. I think that's the proper penance, is to feel death.
Yeah, he apologized, and he was very, very embarrassed, and we never talked about it ever again.
So, talking about language and gender, you write really well about gendered language and how that impacts us. Could you give us some examples of times when people might be using gendered language without knowing it?
Yeah, I think the one word that jumped out immediately is, you know, the term guys to refer to mixed gender groups of people, or even just groups of people where you don't know if everyone identifies as a man or not. That's a word that I've been consciously trying to work out of my vocabulary as well. And I admit I'm not 100% there. I still definitely slip, and I've been trying to do this for 3 years now, probably. I think the bigger thing is just building awareness of when you're doing it. I think eliminating it, or, you know, retraining yourself to verbalize a different word is a longer process. I think it's also important to forgive yourself and other people when they make mistakes. I sort of assume that people want to grow and that people are open to learning, and sort of just try to go from there. But I also don't correct people unless I kind of know them, or, you know, 'cause, like, that's difficult feedback to provide to someone. And I have made the mistake in the past of just, you know, using open Slack channels, or, like, that's the worst way that you can do it. Correcting people on Slack in, like, open source communities with hundreds of people watching is a horrible way of doing it. I don't recommend doing that. There is a time and place for that sort of public affirmation, but I think unless you're in a clear authority position, or it's your community that you built from the ground up, I think that that's a very difficult thing to do. And, you know, it's emotional energy that might not be well invested, but, you know, depends on a lot. But I will say that in terms of specific examples, like, guys is definitely one. Good alternatives are folks, or everyone, or friends. I really like friends, because it's kind of like,
it's an upgrade.
It's an upgrade. You're like, we're not acquaintances, we're friends. Even if someone you've never spoken to directly, that's fine. Other, like, sort of small tweaks that I've seen myself and other people doing are when you talk about people, even in the abstract, who are technical contributors. For example, if you say, the engineer was woken up at 3 a.m., what's the next thing that she should do? Like, people are sort of hardwired to say he, to talk about engineers or, you know, technical people. So trying to work, you know, the she pronoun or they pronoun into scenarios like that can be helpful. I think that's a, you know, like, small rewiring thing that people can start practicing. Yeah, and other than that, I think I've definitely had my eyes open in the last few years from working with communities that are oriented towards diversity in tech and having had the good fortune to make a few friends that have taken me aside and corrected me when I've made mistakes. So one thing I try to be really sensitive of is using people's preferred pronouns even when they're not around, which it sounds minor, but I kind of feel like if someone were talking about me just with me not present in the room and they, you know, called me Dennis, for example, I wouldn't be happy with that, even, you know, even finding out about it weeks or weeks later. So I try to, like, take that sort of same empathetic approach for, you know, like, pronouns are things that matter to people.
I want to talk a little bit more about the guys one. So someone might be listening to this thinking, okay, does that one really matter? Like, why, you know, who does it really hurt? Why is it important to get kind of relatively smaller stuff like guys, right? And show some effort.
I don't know if I feel comfortable just saying that everyone should stop using the term guys in all circumstances, because there definitely are groups of friends, you know, that all know each other and they're comfortable with using that term. And if that's the case, then, you know, by all means, like, in your personal circles, in your private circles, like, by all means, keep, you know, use the language that works for you. But I think when it comes to professional communication or communication that's designed to be, you know, broadcasted towards communities that are related to the work that we do, I think everyone can help shift the needle a little bit. And one way to do that is by changing the language that you use and making it very, very clear who's welcome here and who's not. So, for example, another thing that I've seen is people putting their pronouns in their Twitter profiles. And maybe 2-3 years ago, I didn't do this because I kind of was like, well, you know, it's pretty obvious that I, you know, I'm a woman. I don't need to do this. But then talking to some people who are transgender, non-binary, they told me that, well, you know, if you normalize this, then it becomes easier for us to do it and we don't stick out as much and it's safer. And I was like, oh, yeah, like, it takes 7 characters in my profile. It's so little impact to me. Why wouldn't I do it? So I think by modeling the usage of alternatives to guys, you also sort of flag yourself as a community leader and community member who cares. And I think that that's a way to signal that, you know, for example, like, everyone, hopefully everyone uses codes of conduct, cares about enforcing codes of conduct. It's one small way to make it clear to your attendees that you care about inclusion. You're going to be serious about the code of conduct, and it makes it more likely that incidents will be reported. Hopefully no incidents happen, but if they do, if you're, you know, a community leader, that's something that you would want to know about.
One thing past Wes maybe didn't understand is how important signaling was, that we're always signaling whether we want it or not. So, like, not signaling is also an active signal. So I want to jump into, you gave a talk on analyzing data in debate usage, look for gendered language. You're the captain of your debate team, so you dove in. What did you learn about gender and performance?
So debate is you know, a competitive activity. Like many others, there are scores involved. Oftentimes you'll participate in tournaments. And when you use tournament format, you have people who do really, really well, and they basically make it to the playoffs. We call them out rounds in debate, but it's the same concept, like single elimination tournament at the end with the top 8 or top 16 or whatever it is. In order to even qualify for the playoffs, you need to score really, really high on your individual performance throughout. But as a team, you also need to perform well in terms of your win-loss ratio. So in competitive debating, the way that scores are assigned is it varies a little bit by which format you do, but broadly, the more persuasive you are and the better arguments you make, you should be able to win the round. So that is wide, wide open for interpretation. Some judges are more technical than others, and by technical, I mean they'll write down every single argument that was made and judge based on whether the other team responded to each point, rather than their rhetorical flourish or how emotional they sounded. Some judges are less technical. Some judges will reward rhetorical flourish and overall charisma and presence. So it's a little bit of a roll of the dice what kind of judge you're going to get. But in theory, if you go to enough tournaments over time, that should kind of even itself out. So when I started writing this talk and doing research about this a few years ago, like, of course, my own personal motivation was I don't see a lot of women making it to the playoffs. I don't see a lot of women in the top 10 debaters of the year what's going on. It's not as if there are no women participating in this activity. So I had a friend, Emma, who went to Stanford, and she now is a data scientist. And when she was, I think at some point during her undergrad or master's, I don't really know, she performed statistical analysis of hundreds of different debate rounds and found that, yes, like there is a statistically significant difference in what women debaters score versus what male debaters score. And I'll sort of just like start the caveat here that we don't ask for gender self-identification when it comes to people registering for debate tournaments. So it's also possible that there are non-binary people in there, but we just don't have data on that. And I'm sorry about that. But in terms of if you just try to, and I think what they've generally done is use baby name databases to try to, you know, estimate whether a person by their first name was male or female. So there's a significant difference. And then, which, you know, if you peel that back a little bit, the next question you might want to ask is like, okay, well, is it because women are just more junior than men across the board and the women debaters are just newer, in which case we would expect a discrepancy. But even after you control for, say, for example, you take all the male debaters in their first year and all the female debaters in their first year, there still is that difference. So the next layer to peel back is, okay, maybe there are, is there bias in how the judges issue scores? Like, can we show that some judges are more biased than others? And like, this is kind of a tricky thing to do because the pool is not that big and you don't want to single out individuals. So you kind of have to like do some aggregation, which loses some of the fidelity, but that's okay. But broadly, they divided the judges into a couple categories, female judges and male judges, again, using the same like baby names trick to figure out who is who. And turns out that there is no significant difference in how female judges and male judges perform, I guess, like issue scores. So female judges are just as biased against female debaters as male judges are. So for me, like that was super interesting because debate, you know, debate is this neat little like ecosystem where you can assign a number to everything. You can track performance over time. Like it's very, very data rich. The real world is obviously not like this. But I started to look at this pattern and I was like, well, you know, I think there are parallels to the world of tech and to industry more generally because you're not being scored on a speech that you did, but you are being scored on your performance. You are being assessed on the quality of your work. You are being assessed on, you know, what you deliver. And there's a lot of ambiguity there. And there's a lot of like subjectivity. I've read over the years that we need more women in leadership. We need more women in management. We need to diversify that layer. So that makes me question whether that's actually.
Will it make a difference?
Will it make a difference? Like if we don't address that, there is some, on some level, there's some internalized bias against the ability of women to perform on the same level as men.
We were all part of the same culture. It would be surprising exactly. If we didn't pick up the same things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you had some policy recommendations or proposals in there, some things to think about that might move the needle. I've got it written down if you don't remember your talk from three years ago. Do you remember any of those?
So the Rooney Rule was a rule that they introduced for hiring football coaches for the NFL many, many decades ago. Rooney was a football coach himself who noticed that African-American coaches were just not being hired to coach football teams. So he said, okay, rather, we're not going to implement quotas or anything. I just want all the teams who are hiring coaches to interview one black man. And like it was all men coaching at that time. And over time, like the representation of African-American coaches in the NFL did trend up. So people sort of look at the Rooney Rule and say, okay, you know, that perhaps played a part, but with any kind of social experiment, you know, like experimental data is not clean. We can only sort of guess, we can infer. So the Rooney Rule in terms of gender diversification and I guess like broader, you know, racial and LGBTQ and, you know, that sort of diversification in tech, like if you map that one-to-one, it means that if you're hiring for a manager role or if you're promoting people, you should have at least one candidate under consideration that is from one underrepresented group. You don't have to commit to hiring that person, of course, you know, like we're still not talking about quotas, but we just ask that you interview and take this person seriously.
And is that still something you think is part of the solution potentially?
I think it's part of the solution because like mathematically, if no one in your pipeline is diverse, then you can't diversify. like that's just logically how
it can't hurt. It definitely
it definitely can't hurt, but I still worry that once they make it into the pipeline or once they, you know, get the hiring screening or interviewing, you know, whatever the stages are of whatever role you're hiring for, that we haven't addressed the underlying biases that are still going to make it harder for them to be taken as seriously as their male peers.
It's definitely not a solution, but maybe moves the needle a little bit. I think I've heard people start advocating for the double Rooney rule, which is to have at least two, especially I think this was used in the context of women, that having two more than double the likelihood that one woman would get the promotion or hired, which is interesting math, I guess. It's tough to run the counterfactual. So you wrote about the concept of diminishing marginal returns to social capital and how that might explain why women are sometimes less likely to speak out in the face of transgressions. Could you walk us through that idea a little bit?
I wrote about this a long time ago before I really self-educated on what allyship means. But I think at that point, it was like a desperate cry for help, like, please, somebody help me out here. Because early in my career, I found myself in, you know, the situation over and over again where I was not only the most junior person in the room, I was also the only woman or the only person of color or, you know, the only boot camp grad or whatever it is. So you're often the only person catching when people use gendered language or, you know, like make a crude joke that's not 100% okay in a workplace or things like that. And because you look around the room and you're kind of like, okay, did anyone else catch that comment? Like, we all know that it was not okay for this, you know, for Bob to make that joke about his wife, right? But like, nobody would meet my gaze, and I started to feel like, okay, well, if I don't say anything, then this is a culture that's just going to perpetuate on the team. So I had to learn pretty quickly that if I, you know, said something about a joke or, you know, about something related to inclusion, then that was energy that I permanently lost and couldn't use on things like advocating for technical decisions or trying to get myself even like invited to conversations about technical stuff. And at my first job, I, you know, like tried to use that energy to advocate for things like code quality and test coverage. But I also quickly found that like nobody was really listening to me on that. So it's kind of like when you already have such a small voice, the cost of using that voice to call out something related to D&I is so much higher than what it would cost someone else who already has credibility, already has a louder voice, and, you know, has more of an energy bar to burn on that sort of thing. And something that I didn't really think about until much later on in my career is like, the more that you speak up about D&I related things, the more that becomes your brand. You know, you become the girl who just whines all the time about the lack of women on the team or the lack of women in leadership, rather than the, you know, the engineer who cares about code quality or whatever it is that you deliberately want to be more of your brand. So unfortunately, like, I don't know, I think that can be kind of a cynical approach. Like, I know, we ideally want to live in a world where everyone's just valued for their ideas, but that's not true. Like, the way that you present your ideas and the way that you are perceived by your peers matters a ton in terms of how effectively your ideas will land.
When you talk about personal brand is a phrase that, you know, makes me cringe a little bit still. I think a lot of engineers, but it's real. We have shortcuts and heuristics and stories about how we think about people, and they're always wrong. We ignore that concept at our peril, and it really exists and it's real, even if it's not how we would prefer the world to exist. So I'm curious how you, as someone who's, you know, you wrote about diversity and inclusion, have you found that to be part of your brand to this day?
I think in the community, I'm okay with that being closer to my brand because I, you know, like as I get more senior in my career, I do want people who are earlier in their career to see me as someone who will listen if, you know, something bad happens to them and they just need someone who will listen to them and tell them like, okay, what you experience is not okay. That's not normal. You should not just sit with this. But I think like in my professional life, I've been working for the past 2 years or so on trying to almost like rebrand myself as more technical because I just learned the term for this actually. Executive function skills come really easily to me, which means that organizing like an 80-person meetup is super, super easy for me. It's like almost second nature for me. I know it's not for a lot of people. It still causes me stress. Like, I'm not going to lie about that part, but I know I can do it. And I've done it on my own many, many times. And what I've like generally used that skill for is investing in D&I related initiatives. So when I, you know, worked at Pivotal and the company before, I spent a lot of my non-work energy, you know, like pulling together community events, getting companies to host things, getting companies to sponsor things that I was running, that sort of thing. And I think by doing a lot of that work, that became my visible work. And people started coming and like, you know, it was really fun for a while because I got to be the subject matter expert on all things diversity in tech. And like senior people within the organization would come to me and say like, hey, I was asked to be part of this event. Do you want to join me? Or like, I can't do this panel. Do you want to take my spot? And at first I was like, whoa, that's so cool. Like, that's such a high profile thing to be doing. But then over time I realized, like, but within the company, I'm becoming more and more the D&I person. And that's actually getting me farther from the senior engineer promotion that I want, or, you know, the management opportunity that I want. So I had to eventually start saying no to more of those things, which made me really sad, actually, and start trying to focus on making my visual output more engineering oriented rather than community oriented.
Is there anything other people could do to kind of help you in that rebrand? I'm curious that there might be not.
Yes. I'm so glad that you asked that question, because one hill that I've been dying on for the last few years is getting people to write written feedback for their peers, especially women and non-binary peers. So most companies struggle with promotion processes this is just a human thing. Humans are very, very bad at remembering exact details of an event. In fact, like, if you try, you know, like, even if you've seen a movie 500 times and you know it super, super well, we actually can't mentally step through everything in the movie in real time. Like, I love, you know, Lord of the Rings, for example. You set a timer for 3 hours and my mind will start wandering 3 minutes in. Like, I will not be able to step through that movie. So, like, we're not good at real time memories and real time subjective evaluation. But we're very good at evaluating things in the past with our own narrative and our own lens over what we think happened or what we want to think happened. So when it comes time to evaluate people for their performance, like, that's what we're doing. We're doing subjective evaluation. We're not objective. So, and like, that sort of, there's so, so much research out there suggesting that that sort of subjective evaluation disadvantages women, it advantages men, it advantages people that we already consider to be, you know, like, serious technical contributors, and disadvantages the people, especially those with branding problems, like I did for a lot of, well, I probably still do, with branding problems. So I think one small way that you can combat that, if you work on a team, if you, like, do day-to-day work with someone who you think ought to be recognized more for the work that they're doing, start writing down detailed feedback about what it is they're doing, how they're doing it, what's the impact on your team. And an extra bonus, if you have access to a document like a career ladder that, you know, like, maps out all the different skill proficiencies that people need to be at for, you know, like, senior engineer, staff engineer, principal, whatever it is. Say that, like, your coworker is currently a senior engineer and she really is hoping to be promoted to a staff engineer in the next cycle. One really concrete thing that you can do to help, obviously, you know, if you believe that she is performing that level already, write down, like, you know, for example, Kelly architected this new initiative. She onboarded two people at the same time when we lost team members. She, you know, like, did this and that. And then talk about the impact on your overall team, because at that level, especially at the senior staff principal level, people are looking for team-wide impact or even cross-team impact or cross-organizational impact. So if you can make that super crystal clear, and then, like, you know, hint that, you know, maybe Kelly fits in this box of the career ladder and not her current box, then I think that goes such a long way. And the sooner you can do it, like, the closer chronologically you can be to when the events actually happen, it gives her manager a chance to follow up and, like, you know, pull her aside for a one-to-one and say, hey, like, I heard about this really cool thing you did. Do you want to grab a coffee? And, like, I want to learn more about this. And I just want to make sure that everything is documented. Of course, like, you know, that doesn't translate into a promotion, like, all the time, but it creates less plausible deniability, and it starts to lay a paper trail that even if this person doesn't get the promotion in the next cycle, they can start building a case for either, you know, even the cycle after that, or perhaps for, like, outside of the company, if that's their next step.
So I'm a peer of Kelly, or someone that sees good work and feels like there's a chance it's not going to be recognized. Contemporaneously with the goodness happening, the big initiative, I write something that talks about what she did and the impact. And do I kind of send that to her boss? What would you recommend doing with that written feedback?
So I send it to the manager and I CC Kelly in that case.
So it's like, hey, Steve, this thing Kelly did was awesome. XYZ. Thanks for your work, Kelly. And kind of like,
yep.
Gotcha. I love that. Because Steve is probably lazy, like all of us. So if he can just forward that email to the performance review.
And I also would just add on to that if you do this, try to avoid writing feedback like, Kelly is really nice and she always listens to our problems. Like, there are enough, you know, gender stereotypes as it is that senior level women have to combat, that if you can focus on technical, you know, delivery and, you know, whatever is actually in the career ladder, like the skills that, that can concretely move her to the next level. That's always better because I've gotten feedback like, oh, Denise was so great at organizing the team event. She should do this all the time. And, you know, like I've been pigeonholed into that role and that was actively taking time away for me to work on engineering. And also like in the minds of my peers, I was now the event organizer and not, you know, not their peer technically.
Which is probably not on the career ladder for being a staff engineer.
Yeah, absolutely not.
So let's say I have someone on my team that at this like super high executive function, when like a task that involves organizing, it just like happens. Like they see the work, make it happen. What are some things that might be on that career ladder for, you know, staff engineer that I could help redirect that person towards?
There often are like executive function is definitely a thing that it's not unique to, you know, like non-technical things. It's definitely applicable. I would say one of the things that teams really, really struggle with, and I don't really know any company that's like cracked this. One thing that teams really struggle with is cross-team communication, reducing communication friction, reducing overhead, trying to reduce duplicated work, trying to come up with standards and, you know, conventions. One thing that if you have high executive function that you could do is try to invest in breaking down those communication barriers, like identifying them in the first place. I think a big part of the sort of executive function piece is the ability to identify problems that no one else is seeing. But usually people with this just go and fix the problem on their own. So I think like the more that you can externalize what you're seeing and like level up other people to also be able to train these capabilities goes a super long way.
So what I expect to hear about is you're going to go to GitHub and you're going to find their cross-team collaboration issues and fix them. And then get promoted up the ladder. So that's what I expect to be seeing on,
we'll see about that.
On LinkedIn in a year or two. Yeah, those are hard and important. I wonder if most orgs have something like that on their career ladder. Seems like you should.
Yeah, cross-team impact and cross-org impact is a lot of the time super, super nebulous. Usually what they don't mean is that you set up a lot of meetings with different teams. Although you could be like, oh, I have cross-team impact. I made everyone join this meeting for an hour each week. Like that's not actually what they mean. But if you can figure out how to demonstrate impact and how to even measure it. I know like sometimes engineers think that measurement is like, you know, like organizational or process measurement is in the domain of product managers and other people. I think that's not true. You can still measure things like team health. You can measure things like cycle time. You can even instrument it if you really want to, right? If you already use project tracking tools, you can track the time that stories are in flight. You can track the time that stories are blocked and decisions from other teams. And those are ways that, you know, like if you are in a data-driven organization, those are ways that you can plead your case, sort of.
If it's not already instrumented to be able to track when a team is blocked on a cross-team issue, you instrument that and then you can, you know, that email that you write to your boss about the good thing you did is reduce cross-team blocking from X to Y. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, possibly. This is like potentially another rabbit hole, but I have this kind of personal opinion that if teams spend a lot of time on with stories and block state, then the teams are organized incorrectly, but that's probably a separate conversation.
Let's pull on that. So why is that a team organization problem if you're blocked?
Because in my view, an engineering team should be the smallest possible autonomous unit to solve a problem. So as smallest, I don't mean that means like you have, you know, everyone at a high, you know, 100% capacity or anything. I just mean that you don't put extra people on a room who make it longer, who cause the team to take longer to reach consensus. But also like sometimes the team needs consensus. Sometimes you just need input from others, like on the team or outside of the team.
So make sure I understand that. I think you're saying an extra person would add enough communication overhead potentially that they're actually reducing value on the team.
Yeah, in some cases. Got to kind of be careful with that though, because I don't want this to come across as like you shouldn't have people disagreeing on a team, because disagreement is healthy. Like disagreement is a necessary part of exploring a problem fully and making sure that you are moving forward with the right solution. So that's not what I'm trying to say.
That's why diversity, it's one of the levers why diversity actually matters, is because it creates disagreement, creates better decisions. You see things from different angles. So there's a Goldilocks zone.
Exactly. But having, you know, too many voices in a room, as you mentioned, does take longer to reach an agreement. And sometimes you just need to choose something to try and move forward, especially when you're operating in a space or time of high uncertainty. But in terms of like having teams be the autonomous unit, if you find that a team is constantly blocked in decision from, you know, another team or a director or a manager of another team, then that to me is a really strong smell. And by like constantly block, I would say like you are spending hours, like multiple hours a week, that stories can't progress because you just like find yourself unable to move forward. Because that indicates that the team maybe has the right information, but they don't have the right autonomy, or they don't have the right trust or the right capability to move forward with the decisions that they've made. At which point, like, you're not operating as an autonomous team. Like, you are kind of being puppeted by someone outside of the team, and maybe things move faster if you just move that person or that, you know, like other group of people who are constantly blocking decisions, like move them closer to the team. Maybe do some team swaps. Maybe if it's like context that you're missing because some, you know, domain expert is outside of the team, what would it look like to rotate that domain expert to the team for just a few weeks until everybody else on the team can level up?
Denise, I wish I would have talked to you about 6 months ago, because I think we like saw our way in the dark around this issue in our company. So I'm, you know, we're 7 people, and we had a half-time product manager who's also an engineer, but I'm the one out talking to prospects and customers, and we would have product decisions, and I would be a blocker, but I'm not really on the product team and the engineering team. And what we ended up doing is rotating me closer to that team, and now we're less blocked and things are moving much exactly what you said. We rotated the team and now we're spending a lot less time blocked.
Yeah, no, I think tracking the time that you spend in block state is really important. It takes a toll on team health over time too, because people will start to get this feeling their hands are tied and like they're not trusted. And the reason why is because they can't fully make decisions.
That's a horrible feeling. My guest today has been Denise Yu. Denise, thank you for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Denise for sharing her experience with us. Here are a couple takeaways that I had from our chat. Number one, gendered language matters. It matters because of signaling. We are always signaling. Even by not signaling, we are signaling something to the people around us. We are apes hardwired for this stuff. So we get to choose what we signal. We can say things like guys instead of things like folks or friends, and we signal that we don't care so much about inclusion. Another slice of inclusion is using people's preferred pronouns. We should use those all the time, including behind their back. One way that we can signal that we care about people's preferred pronouns is by using pronouns in our Twitter bio. This is the I'm Spartacus principle. We can help other folks stand out less. Denise also covers gendered language in debate performance. She dove into the data to look at why women were not making it to debate playoffs. It's also important to realize that we will get this wrong. Other people will get this wrong. And when we correct people, it's important to not do it publicly. Number two, we have a responsibility as allies to speak out. Everyone at our organization has an energy bar. How much energy in that bar is political capital. If we rely on only the most junior people, women, boot camp grads, minorities, underrepresented folks, to speak out and raise the flag when there are problems, this is gendered language, inappropriate jokes, we're asking them to use some of their limited energy bar on this problem. They can see it as a situation where if they don't see anything, that culture will perpetuate. Instead, we can use some of our political capital to make a big difference. So I want to emphasize, it's not just that someone says something. It matters who says something and the relative energy bars for those folks. It can make a huge difference for someone more senior in the hierarchy to use their energy speaking out. In Denise's experience, this translated to her having to make a trade-off. Does she want to be known as the we need more women on the team person or the code quality person, when the code quality person is the person that probably gets promoted faster and moves through their career better? Number three, written documentation and the double Rooney rule can help us narrow gendered gaps. The Rooney rule is from the NFL. It says you have to interview one black man before you make the hire, and this is in the context of NFL. No quota, but you have to interview someone. The double Rooney rule is an extension that was used at Pivotal Labs that says the interview process can't start until at least 2 people from underrepresented groups are in the pipeline. That ensures we fix our pipeline problem if there is one, and we avoid tokenism. Outside of the double Rooney rule, written feedback to peers is important, especially for underrepresented groups. we aren't as good at real-time memories and feedback, and we're pretty good at telling subjective stories based on experience, and the written feedback allows us to document great performance. We can send written feedback to peers praising their performance and copying their manager, and that makes it easier for them to get promoted. It becomes documentation for them moving up the career ladder. This is an easy thing we can do today. You see a peer doing something awesome, write about it. Thanks again to Denise for coming on the show. Now, I want to hear from you. If you have any questions about growing a remote team, please email me at wes@woventeams.com. I read every email personally, and I'm excited to help you solve your problem. Until next week, keep on scaling.